At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Natural gas, children's books, and municipal bankruptcies on the broadcast today. Let the wild rumpus start. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 8th of May. Good as always to have you with us. The Obama administration is back on the energy issue again. Out in Utah today, the Secretary of the Interior approved a plan that'll let Anadarko Petroleum drill as many as 3,600 new natural gas wells. Now, if you've been following natural gas prices, you know where I'm going here. What's up with drilling for new supplies when prices are already so low and potentially unprofitable? From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong has the story.
It's the second time in a week the Obama administration has gushed about promoting natural gas drilling. Meanwhile, oil and gas lobbyists regularly blast the administration for obstruction, regulating, delaying, and taxing energy production. So who's right? Maybe nobody.
This is almost entirely a technology story. Good old-fashioned American entrepreneurialism.
Independent energy economist Philip Verleger says policy schmalacy.
Neither this administration nor any other administration has really done much at all other than make available land.
Verleger sees the U.S. gas story as a tectonic shift in global energy. Production has surged 53% in 7 years. So now we have a glut and bargain basement prices. Some companies are losing money. But Verleger says others are still drilling because they locked in high prices through financial markets and hedging.
Wall Street needs to take a victory lap since they keep getting criticized for everything they did in the housing market and everything. This is a true American success story.
And power plants are binge buying. They burn 34% more gas than a year ago. Industry consultant John Hanger.
It's almost been a one-for-one displacement of coal by natural gas over the last decade.
You'd think all this would push up prices, but energy investors keep getting burned. There's so much natural gas out there. Hanger thinks prices will double in a few years, but immediately pulls out the disclaimer. Spend enough time in the energy business, he says, and you're going to be wrong pretty quickly. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Maurice Sendak died today, as you probably heard. Doesn't really take much to conjure up his best-known book other than for me to say the night Max wore his wolf suit and made mischief of one kind or another. But for as many copies of Where the Wild Things Are as have been sold, the children's book business today is no fairy tale, as Marketplace's Sally Herships reports.
I'm going to start this story with a happy ending. The market for children's books is doing pretty well. Peter Glassman owns Books of Wonder, a children's bookstore in New York.
People want to repeat their childhood experiences that they loved with their children.
And the big bad wolf, trying to huff and puff and blow down all the bricks and mortar stores, I'm talking about ebooks, they haven't made a chink in sales. So far, Glassman says the Kindles, Nooks, and iPads of the world are no match for a paper children's book.
A book is a physical object. It has weight, it has feel, it has texture.
It has sentiment. And if you drop it in the tub at story time, it doesn't take a year's allowance to replace. That's why there aren't more picture books available as ebooks. And even when books for kids and young adults are available as ebooks, buyers still want to crack the binding. The Association of American Publishers says so far this year, sales for old-fashioned paper books for kids and young adults are 50% more than last year. But here's a mystery.
I've looked at statistics from a number of different sources that show children's and young adult reading trends, and they've pretty much been going absolutely nowhere.
Michael Norris is an analyst with Simba Information. He says a lot of young adult books, like The Hunger Games, are being bought by adults. And when paper editions are bought instead of digital, well, that would make Maurice Sendak happy. I tell you what he said about ebooks, but not until after bedtime. It's not fit for little ears. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
All right, with that caveat, I won't make you wait. I'll tell you what he said. I hate them, Maurice Sendak said of ebooks. It's like making believe there's another kind of sex. There isn't another kind of sex, he said. There isn't another kind of book. A book is a book is a book. Maurice Sendak, dead today at 83. In China today, there was yet another high-profile story with potentially international implications. The government in Beijing has forced the popular news channel Al Jazeera English to close its only bureau in China and expelled its reporter. The decision comes at a domestically sensitive time. Beijing is bogged down by a scandal involving a top party official, and it's getting flack about its human rights record. But as bad as things are for the government, this is even worse news for Al Jazeera English, as our China correspondent Rob Schmitz reports.
So you're one of the fastest growing news networks in the world, and now you're not allowed to cover the fastest growing economy in the world. Mike Chinoy is a former CNN journalist. Now he's a senior fellow at USC's U.S.-China Institute. He says Al Jazeera's English news service is in a tough position.
Clearly, China's a huge story, and it's a blow not to have a reporter on the scene covering it. That's especially true at the moment when there have been so many big stories coming out of China.
This is the first time in 14 years that an accredited foreign journalist has been essentially expelled from China. This time around, the Chinese government hasn't explained why. Though Al Jazeera's correspondent focused much of her work on human rights stories, Beijing-based media analyst Jeremy Goldkorn says so do many other foreign journalists.
Al Jazeera wasn't an anti-China news organization. They were, if I may use an American TV station's catchphrase, rather fair and balanced, I think.
Goldkorn says China's made a bad PR move, but maybe not. China's state-run CCTV has just opened a new news operation in Washington, D.C., hiring dozens of people, says Mike Chinoy.
So you do have Chinese journalists going abroad in greater and greater numbers, even as their foreign counterparts in China are encountering greater and greater difficulties.
In other words, China's campaign to show its best side is alive and well. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, kind of a tale of two markets, actually. In the morning, traders seemed to clue into what's going on in Europe. In the afternoon, they apparently decided it didn't matter very much anyway. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The American Psychiatric Association's annual meeting in Philadelphia winds down today. The main topic of conversation has been a new revision to the DSM. That's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. It's pretty much the Bible of psychiatric diagnoses, used for everything from insurance claims to deciding social services. And what those diagnoses are can mean getting tens or maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of social services. So what happens when, with especially subtle conditions like autism, the diagnosis changes? From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner reports.
Susan Sweeto is chair of the committee that spent the last five or so years tweaking the official definition of autism. On Sunday, she and I huddled in the back of a conference hall in Philadelphia. She was whispering to not disturb the other psychiatrists in the room. She says that the biggest change we're going to see in the definition is this. Under the old criteria, even one symptom might have gotten you a diagnosis.
The old thing was, they don't make eye gaze, they must have autism.
The new criteria will ask psychiatrists to do more than that. They'll have to rank patients on a scale of severity for a range of factors, from social skills to repetitive behaviors to verbal abilities. So figure a child would get a different score if he can speak single words or phrases or full sentences.
Our criteria are much more complex than the old ones. It provides a richer description of what you're trying to get.
Geraldine Dawson of the advocacy group Autism Speaks agrees the new criteria are richer and more scientifically valid. But it's not the science the parents are worried about.
If a family, for example, must now pay out of pocket for services that they used to receive because they qualified under a diagnosis, for early intervention, that's going to cost them maybe $50,000 a year.
David Mandel is Associate Director of the Center for Autism Research at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
Trying to think about the best way to say this. There used to be very few advantages associated with the diagnosis of autism.
But he says as families fought back and more research showed the benefits of early intervention, an autism diagnosis came to mean access to a better class of services. According to the folks at Autism Speaks, school districts spend an average of $20,000 per autistic child, 3 to 5 times more than they spend on kids in regular special ed.
So if I have a kid with idiopathic intellectual disability, that is, I don't know the cause of the intellectual disability, I might try to get them diagnosed with autism in order to get them some of the services that are often available for those kids.
That kid may not qualify under the new criteria. But Sue Sweeto wants to reassure parents that kids who are getting an accurate diagnosis will still be covered. She says in a recent study of 600 kids officially diagnosed at academic medical centers, just as many of them got the diagnosis of autism under the old criteria as under the new. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
While the national economy is growing, according to the raw numbers anyway, states and especially cities are still in no small amount of trouble. Here in California, there's a lot of talk of municipal bankruptcies. Stockton might soon become the biggest city in the country to go that route. In the San Francisco Bay Area, the suburb of Hercules faced a similar fate, so city officials cut their budget and their staff nearly in half. Capital Public Radio's Marianne Russ has that story.
The tale of Hercules involves dynamite, some pretty explosive city politics, and failed investments.
This building right here is on part of what was the dynamite factory.
Councilman Bill Wilkins is showing us around Hercules. It was a company town for California Powder Works until the 1960s. The city's named for the signature product, Hercules Dynamite. When the plant closed, there was a boom of a different kind, housing. We drive through a cheerful new urbanist neighborhood. Craftsman-style homes are clustered close to parks and shops. But like so many California communities, home values in Hercules have plummeted. Wilkins says million-dollar homes are now worth half as much.
I mean, right on my street of the original neighbors that we had, half of them are gone.
Meantime, the city was pumping borrowed money into development projects that didn't pan out. The most spectacular failure is a group of unfinished apartment buildings. The city spent more than $35 million trying to build them, ran out of money, and recently sold the complex for less than $500,000. Here's Mayor Dan Romero.
We lived high on the hog, and the reality is that in all the years of City of Hercules and all the money that was spent in redevelopment, they never built a building. There are no revenues coming in.
That's part of the reason the city was on the brink of bankruptcy. Romero took office last year after a recall election that led to a complete turnover of the city council. To close a multi-million dollar deficit, they slashed the city budget and staff nearly in half. The police force was cut by a third. No 4th of July fireworks. And the cultural festival the city's had for over 25 years, that's gone too. Councilman Bill Wilkins says the painful measures were necessary after so much overspending. But he believes Hercules is now turning the corner.
What we're going through now are the trials and tribulations of Hercules, and it borders on a Greek tragedy. It really does. But, the play is almost over.
The Powder Keg is a pub-style eatery in one of the city's newer neighborhoods. Nicolette Andriga owns the place. She says despite the city's mess, business isn't bad.
They still come out. They still have to eat, I guess, and have a drink once in a while.
Alex Fernandez is eating lunch with his daughter, Olivia. He says the cuts haven't affected him much either.
You can see a little bit of infrastructure take a little bit of hit. It's not being kept up as well, especially the city park. But overall, the quality of life and the people here, it's been fine.
But despite the city's fiscal failures, Hercules is still dreaming big. That old dynamite factory site, it's evolving again, this time into a major new transit center, shops, restaurants, and even more housing. In Hercules, California, I'm Marianne Russ for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Everyone knows they've cut too far. Britain looks embarrassed when people are queuing at the airports. And frankly, the Olympics is a disaster waiting to happen.
Stress testing the London Games. But first, let's do the numbers. After what you can only call a really lousy open, the Dow Industrials finished the day down 76 points, 0.5%, ended at 12,932, the fifth straight day of losses for the blue chips, if you're counting. The Nasdaq deleted 11 points, 0.3%, 2946 at the bell. The S&P 500 down 5 points, nearly 0.5%, finished at 1363. McDonald's spilled 2% today after missing expectations for global sales. Electronic Arts unplugged more than 4%. Fossil ticked down 37% after weak sales. Scott's Miracle-Gro wilted 16%. A couple of retailers were among the rare winners today. The Vitamin Shoppe scooped up 15%. Office Max scrolled up 11% today. Bank of America down 2%. Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, Chase, and Wells Fargo all unloaded about 1%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.84%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on wholesale inventories and sales for March. The Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee discusses limiting federal support for financial institutions. And journalist Mike Wallace was born on May 9, 1918. He would have been 94. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is almost all the time a family radio program, and the next four or so minutes aren't going to stray from that. But on the theory that forewarned is forearmed, here goes. We have a certain cultural obsession in this world with breasts, psychologically, socially, sexually, you name it. And people might giggle, but Florence Williams is dead serious. Her new book is called Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History. Florence Williams, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I say this literally with a straight face, but I think it's the right place to start. Breasts in this country aren't what they used to be, right? They're bigger. They're more engineered. Women are getting them younger. It's not the way it was when we were kids.
It's true. Breasts are one of our organs that have really changed over the generations. I talked to someone at Maidenform who said that the average breast size used to be a 34B, and now it's closer to a 34C and pushing upwards toward a D. And this is new.
The subtitle is a natural and unnatural history, but it's really, you say in the book, an environmental history of breasts. Explain what that means, would you?
Breasts are very environmentally sensitive. For example, breasts are filled with estrogen receptors. And so breast cells are really attuned to estrogen, and they're designed to really pick them up. And that's how breasts know, for example, when to grow in puberty through these environmental cues. And now in our modern life, we are really surrounded by industrial chemicals that mimic estrogen. And so breasts are arriving earlier. The average age for breast budding now is about 9 or 10, and even younger. This is something that a lot of parents are concerned about, because when young girls get big breasts earlier, it really changes the way their peers treat them. And it's also a risk for breast cancer later on.
You were breastfeeding your children, right? One of your children, when you were reading some article about the toxins you find in breast milk?
I was, and I actually nursed out a sample of my breast milk, and I sent it to a lab in Germany. And it turns out that I had pretty high levels of flame retardants.
Wow.
And I also had some pesticides in my breast milk. We actually have no idea where these chemicals are coming from. Hmm. Are they in my office equipment? Are they in my roofing tiles? We just really don't know. And that's because products in the marketplace that we buy are not required to be labeled. As a parent, it's really frustrating because I realize that we really can't control our exposure very much.
Asking delicately as he can, did you think much about your breasts before you became a mother, before they actually had this utilitarian purpose?
You know, it's funny. I really didn't think that much about them. It wasn't until I started breastfeeding that I became aware of how complicated breasts are. One problem, of course, is that women often are ashamed of breastfeeding. And in our culture anyway, we're not really supposed to breastfeed in public. When we do, we run into all sorts of problems. And that's, of course, such a huge change from how we evolved, where, you know, breasts were literally just hanging out all over the place and were used to feed infants during a woman's reproductive lifespan. And so we don't really support breastfeeding enough as a culture. We don't support it enough in the workplace. And, you know, for a lot of women, it's just too much to handle. And I totally respect that.
Florence Williams. Her book is called Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
We've got an excerpt on our website. It's marketplace.org/thebigbook. In about 3 months' time, the spectacle that is the Summer Olympics is going to land in London. The British capital is limbering up, but as with all Olympiads, there are doubts about preparedness. So authorities are putting the city through its paces, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
A jet fighter tears through the London sky. Operation Olympic Guardian is underway. A huge military exercise designed, says John Gearson of King's College, not only to deter the terrorists.
But they're also trying to reassure the public that the armed forces, as well as the police, are taking Olympic security seriously.
But some Londoners are not reassured. Nadine Moses says the military have just told her there'll be a missile battery on the roof of her apartment block, not far from the Olympic Park. She now feels she's a terrorist target.
It is a bit worrying that they're actually going to put missiles on the roof. It is a bit terrifying.
Other residents say the missiles are an overreaction, but the government's also been accused of underreacting to the likely influx of millions of Olympic visitors.
Mohammed Khalid, please go to the immigration desk. Mohammed Khalid to the immigration desk.
Over the past 2 weeks, London's Heathrow Airport has suffered massive delays. Some incoming passengers have been forced to wait up to 3 hours to have their passports checked. Lawmaker Keith Vaz.
Scenes at Heathrow are deeply embarrassing, damaging to the reputation of the country and damaging to the standing of London as a world-class city.
The union that represents the passport control staff blames austerity measures. The government has cut 100 jobs at Heathrow. Appearing on a BBC discussion show, the union boss, Mark Sawatka, said it doesn't bode well for the Olympics.
Everyone knows they've cut too far. Britain looks embarrassed when people are queuing at the airports. And frankly, the Olympics is a disaster waiting to happen.
The government says it will deploy an extra 500 immigration staff at Heathrow during the Games, and moves are afoot to ease congestion on London's notoriously overcrowded subway, the Tube.
Mind the gap. Stand clear of the doors, please.
When the Games open at the end of July, the world will be watching to see how London performs. The city is anxious that it doesn't fall flat on its face at the first hurdle. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today in which the future comes to the great state of Nevada. The DMV there has issued its first driverless car license. The recipient is a Prius, tricked out by Google. But what kind of license does a car without a driver get?
Anyway, we called up Bruce Breslow to find out. He's the director of the Nevada Department of Motor Vehicles.
It's a business license, and it won't be a driverless car because it's a testing license, and there must be two operators in the car at all times.
How do we, as regular motorists, should I drive up to Las Vegas this weekend, how do I know that it's a driverless car other than, you know, well, I won't actually, right, because you'd see two people. So how do I know it's a driverless car?
Well, if it's Google's test car, you'll see a spinning turret with laser radar on
top.
Whoa,
wait, what?
It is a laser radar combination that sees 360. So while you can see out the front of your car, it sees sideways behind you and everything around you in your environment. It sees better than you do. So that's the first giveaway. The second would be a bright red license plate with an infinity symbol in gold that says autonomous vehicle.
Where'd the red license plate with infinity come from?
My imagination, actually.
Have you ridden in this thing?
I've gone on several test drives. You can see the laptop that shows what the vehicle sees, and that it sees a lot more than you can see. It sees a pedestrian, a pothole. It sees three cars in front where I'm blocked by the car in front of me, but this has the laser radar that skips under that car, picks up the next one, skips under that, picks up the next one. It relaxes you quite a bit.
Now, let's say something goes wrong and a red light is run or a fender bender is had. Who gets the ticket?
The owner of the vehicle is responsible for the vehicle.
All right.
But keep in mind, before you blame it on the car, there's a hard drive in there that will record 30 seconds prior to the accident. So if you say a deer jumped out in front of the car, they can prove that a deer didn't jump out of the car.
Is it like when I was learning how to drive and my mom was sitting in the passenger seat and every time something would get a little hairy, she would pump a fake brake pedal and go, Kai?
Initially, I thought that might be the case.
Yeah.
The car's a lot smoother in its maneuvers. It's great technology.
Bruce Breslow, he runs the Nevada DMV, talking about driverless cars that are now legal there. A bit about my mom, by the way. Totally true. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow fell 76 points, about a half percent. The NASDAQ deleted 11 points, a third of 1%. The S&P 500, why it closed down 5 points, nearly a half percent. Thanks today to Mary Dew, Justin Ho, and Ethan Lindsay on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.